شر قدامك شخص غريب. من وين جيت من وين نبات بالمدينة نتذكر فيها الحب والحب حب الخلايا نامت وما عاد تفيق. جيت من رواية الحي نظيف الكل يوم شوف فيه زبالة ولا وسخ عم تلعب على الطريق.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bennett Ramberg, who was formerly a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of the book Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Politico, The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bennett Ramberg.
Well, thank you, Ian.
And your article at Politico basically is arguing that there's a lot more at stake in Syria than the future of the country and its dictator and the people that are being killed by the dictatorship and fighting for their freedom. Close to 8,000, 7,500 people have died at the hands of the security forces. That's probably an underestimation given that there's no press allowed in there. But what is protecting Assad is the UN's charter that basically has this state sovereignty provision that basically allows Assad to get away with murder.
That's right. Under Article 2 of the UN Charter, states are sovereign. They can do what they want within their borders. And the international community cannot intervene, even though a dictator or a leader may be slaughtering his people.
And
it's quite astonishing, but understandable at the time the charter was inaugurated. The question is, should we modify that provision today? And there's efforts afoot to do so.
Well, just in terms of dictators who slaughter their own people, there have been more deaths in these wars that we've seen within these countries than there have been from wars involving, you know, say foreign invaders, for example. Sudan from 55 to 72, estimated 500,000 have been killed. In Indonesia, 65 to 1966, 400,000 died. Uganda from 72 to 79, estimated 300,000 were killed. Cambodia from 75 to 79, an estimated 2.5 million died. And in post-war Vietnam from 75 on 365,000. And in Iraq, 79 to 2003, an estimated...
Yeah, I mean, isn't that astonishing? Doesn't it say it all?
Well,
the international community has failed.
Totally, but it's, at least the Canadians woke up in about 2000 and spurred on by the tragedies in Rwanda and Bosnia, and they convened an international commission on intervention and state sovereignty, out of which they produced this report called Responsibility to Protect, or R2P. So tell us about R2P and where it stands.
Well, this convention of former diplomats and others try to address the question whether the time has come for the international community to review its the sovereignty provision in the United Nations Charter, and to ask themselves whether it's time for when countries are slaughtering their own people, leaders are slaughtering their own people, murdering their own people, whether the international community ought to intervene. And they were driven by Rwanda. 800,000 people lost their lives, and what happened in the former Yugoslavia as well. And they came to the conclusion and authored a doctrine called Responsibility to Protect. And I would urge all of your leaders to go onto the web and read this remarkable document. They encourage the international community to look again at this particular issue of internal matters that result in the mass murder of populations and ask themselves whether the United Nations should, in point of fact, intervene into the affairs of states when crimes against humanity are being committed.
So in 2005, a world summit was convened, right? And this is the largest gathering of leaders in history at the United Nations General Assembly. What happened?
Well, this was, as you said, the largest convocation, and the statesmen did agree in principle that there should be a new prescription by the United Nations which would address issues of genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity committed by leaders against their own countries. And they asked the General Assembly to consider the matter, and the General Assembly picked up the matter in 2009. And spent 2 days on the issue. There was a lot of bickering, and nothing occurred.
So is that to do with the fact that a lot of the General Assembly members are thugs? And
well, it was that, arguably, but more they were bickering about all sorts of issues in this context. How many members there should be on the Security Council, how many permanent members ought to be on the Security Council, shall we revise the Security Council? So all sorts of ancillary issues came up during this discussion. And since 2009, the matter was not considered again, but then came Libya.
So, Libya, again, let me just let's stop you for a second and remind the audience I'm speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was formerly a foreign policy analyst at the Bureau of Politico Military Affairs at the Department of State under the George H.W. Bush administration. He has an article at Politico, "The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter." So then came Libya.
And early in 2011, the question was asked, what should the Security Council do about Libya? This was brought to the Security Council's attention by the Arab League that said a no-fly zone should be established to prevent the Gaddafi regime from overrunning rebel positions, overrunning the city of Benghazi, and murdering large fractions of the rebel population there. And remarkably, the Security Council decided to endorse and adopt, effectively, responsibility to protect, to allow air power to enter Libyan airspace to try to protect the population. The United States and its NATO allies, however, extended this beyond that to overthrow the Gaddafi regime.
So this is cited, the Libyan intervention, as the reason why the Chinese and the Russians veto the recent UN efforts, Security Council efforts, to apply similar sanctions against the Assad regime, or at least to up the ante on the Assad regime. Now, is that true, or are there some other, you know, more self-serving motives here? I mean, as the UN, our UN rep in Susan Rice, at the time of that vote, said she's disgusted with some of the members, referring to Russia in particular, who are selling arms to the Syrian regime and have military bases and have clear interests, as opposed to this idea that somehow China and Russia got conned and burned by the West by what happened over Libya.
Mind you, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton likewise said recently that she's disgusted, very disgusted as well, about Russia's behavior. Now, the Russian position, at least formally, is that the application of responsibility to protect to Syria would be a slippery slope. And from the Russian point of view, they argue that there was a slippery slope in Libya. They say the resolution simply required or asked, mandated that the combatants, the air combatants, protect the civilian population in Libya, not overthrow the government. Now, in Syria, the Russians have an ally, and that's one rationale to protect the Syrian government. It is a Syrian ally of long standing. It receives the Syrians purchase arms from Russia. The Russians have a naval facility in Syria. Russia wants a stake in the Middle East, and Syria provides that. Remarkably, Russia endorses no action on the part of the Security Council at this time. But there's another reason, because the Russians and the Chinese, arguably, are looking in the mirror. And they say, this is a slippery slope that could apply to us. If there's unrest in Russia or China in the future, some countries could claim that this responsibility to protect could or should be applied to Russia or China.
Well, so when the Russians were in, after all, it was Putin that started the second Chechen War,
yes,
and it was precipitated by the bombing of apartment buildings in the outskirts of Moscow, the details of which still remain mysterious to this day. Was there some kind of did we turn a blind eye? Was there a trade-off there? You know, you can go ahead and kill your own people. Why did we not make more of a fuss about what was happening in Chechnya at the time it was happening?
Well, mind you, the principle of responsibility to protect wasn't
in place
at the time.
Right.
And it just didn't reach the status that it has now in public discourse and dialogue.
No.
Clearly, you know, what happened in Chechnya was a tragedy. I'm of a view with regard to civil conflicts that governments should let their people go, essentially. Elements of population wish to segregate themselves from the homeland, so to speak, because they simply can't get along, then the consideration should be given to confederation, federation, or actually countries departing from the situation, or rather nationalities departing from the situation they find themselves in. Mind you, there have been countries that have broken themselves apart, such as the Soviet Union, such as Czechoslovakia, such as the former Yugoslavia, although that was done in a violent way. So there are precedents for this. Leaving that aside, the United States adhered to the doctrine, that is Article 2 of the UN Charter, which said, well, what happens within a country, we can object to it, we can raise all sorts of issues associated with it, but we cannot intervene. The Canadian 2001 initiative, however, raises to the fore again because of Rwanda and what happened in the former Yugoslavia.
Well, you know, it, obviously you're not going to get the Chinese to suddenly wake up one day and feel benevolent and say to the Tibetans, we're terribly sorry for the way we treated you.
Absolutely. So they're not going to endorse this, what they believe is a slippery slope. Right. They want adherence to Article 2 of the UN Charter.
So what then do you think can happen here in terms of R2P in the context of what's happening in Syria now? Is because the UN humanitarian representative is now the Syrians wouldn't let her in, and now even Russia and China are voting to force the Syrians to let her in. So something's happening there in terms not so much responsibility to protect, but at least some credibility of the United Nations in terms of the humanitarian catastrophe that's taking place inside of Syria.
Well, in my article, I call for a fourfold policy. First, I think the Arab League should revisit their call for the removal of Assad. They should call for the removal of Assad and his ruling clique. After all, the regime is more than the leader. Second, I suggest that there should be, in a sense, a propaganda campaign directed at the Syrian military, encouraging them to defect to the rebel side or, by a date certain, to avoid prosecution, join the rebels. Third, I call for covert military aid so resistors can contest Assad's infantry, armor, and helicopters. And fourth, foreign mediation to help mold the divided opposition and into a united, internationally recognized government in waiting. So those are the options that I propose. Others have proposed others as well. But I don't think it's likely that the United States or other countries are going to intervene militarily. Syria is a quagmire. We're not going to get into another quagmire.
Well, but already there is an intervention. The Qataris have sent a force in. I believe the Turks are sending in a covert special operations force to work with the Free Syrian Army. There have even been some suggestions from Hillary Clinton that arms may find their way.
That's correct. She has said that. But as far as American intervention, American air power, I think it's unlikely. I think Syria poses greater challenges than Libya did, and there's limits, particularly in the presidential year, in terms of what the United States is willing to do.
Well, nobody's calling for them. You're not calling for them, right?
I am not. No, I'm not.
You're just saying that they can use some PSYOP methods of trying to influence the Syrian military to defect.
Yes, I believe that could be one strategy. I haven't heard anybody talk about that. That is propagandize the Syrian military to defect.
But what about the basis for the support for the Assad clique? Is still there's a substantial number of people in Syria that support the Assads, particularly the minority Christians and other minorities, and the Alawites, of course, who are the ones that are meeting out all of the brutality, because there will be blood, there'll be retribution, there'll be revenge.
And well, that's why the government in waiting, as I call it, should be a broad-based government, not limited to one sect or the other, but should be representative of the entire population. I think that's critical.
Well, obviously the specter that's overshadowing this is what happened in Iraq, and surely that's informing the people who are supporting this regime, right, and particularly the Christians.
I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but I'm saying this is the cards we've been dealt. Syria is a multifaceted country in terms of populations and sects, and this has to be representative in a government that will succeed, succeed the Assad regime. But let me just add one other point. I mean, what happens in Syria is going to have implications for other circumstances where countries turn on their people. If we don't and are unable get rid of this particular regime, other dictators will say to themselves, well, we can hold out as well. This shouldn't be the mantra for this 21st century. There should be a change. You know, you listed all the cases of hundreds of thousands of people losing their lives while the world stood and watched. This can't be allowed in this 21st century. It's unconscionable.
Well, it is, and it's been that way for some time. And more often than not, we, out of frustration, we invoke sanctions, which end up punishing the people and not the dictators. And we've gone to war just to get rid of people like Saddam Hussein, and that's the collateral damage to the people has been morally unsupportable in terms of just getting rid of the dictator. So clearly, there's a terrible, terrible missing. Crying need for some kind of workable mechanism, and I guess you think, and it's probably the only place that could do it would be the UN, and you think R2P is the way to go.
Well, I think R2P is the way to go. I'm not saying things will work out smoothly. They haven't been working out particularly smoothly in Libya, but this takes time. This can take years to cobble together a new legitimated government. So we shouldn't ask more than is reasonable to expect when you have fractured societies that haven't been functioning effectively. It will take time, and that's what we can hope for in the Syrian case and, frankly, other cases as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Bennett Ramberg.
Thank you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Bennett Ramberg, who was formerly a foreign policy analyst in the Bureau of Politico-Military Affairs at the Department of State during the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the author of the book Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy and Unrecognized Military Peril. And he has an article at Politico, The World Must Stop Syrian Slaughter. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.